Biden administration comes under growing criticism over a surge in migrant arrivals, as new photos show the squalid conditions of immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. The UN chief voices his concern about the rise of violence against Asians following the killing of six Asian American women in a shooting spree in Atlanta. Also ahead, the death toll from Sunday's coordinated gun attacks on villages in southwestern Niger rises to 137. Good to have you with us. Now, our top story this hour. New photos have emerged showing the squalid conditions of immigrants being kept at a processing center near the U.S.-Mexico border. Migrants could be seen crowding together and sleeping on the floor at the border facility in Donner, Texas. The photos come amid the criticism of U.S. President Joe Biden's policy regarding immigration, as record numbers of asylum seekers have been flooding into the country. The White House is particularly under fire for the conditions in overcrowded detention centers for unaccompanied immigrant children. More than 10,000 kids, including many of those forcibly separated from their parents, are now in the care of the Department of Health and Human Services. 5,000 others are also stranded in Border Patrol facilities not designed for long-term custody. The UN Secretary General has voiced concern about rising violence against Asians and people of Asian descent across the globe. Antonio Guterres said Asian communities around the world have been increasingly targeted by verbal and physical attacks, as well as bullying, both in schools or on social media. He added that in some countries, Asian women have been specifically targeted, which adds a misogynistic angle to the already racist move. Although he didn't name any specific country, the UN chief's comments come in the aftermath of a shooting spree in the U.S. city of Atlanta, which left six women of Asian descent dead. A spate of hate crimes against the Asian American community in the U.S. has sparked a public outcry across the country. Activist and political commentator Media Benjamin says the U.S. foreign policy regarding China has added fuel to the fire of racism in the country.
Well, I think one of the things that's not being talked about enough is connecting the racism to U.S. foreign policy, and particularly the anti-China policy. It was not only President Trump who talked about the Kung Flu and the China virus, but also we now see Biden's Secretary of State in his opening meeting with the Chinese representatives chastising them instead of conducting real diplomacy. And the messages that are coming from the U.S. government are ones that China is our enemy, that we have to build up our military to confront China. And all of this adds to the anti-Asian American sentiment in the United States. So we're calling on the Biden administration not only to denounce the these as hate crimes, but also to stop the Cold War with China.
So one of our earlier stories regarding the U.S. immigration crisis at the border, joining us is Colin Campbell, our correspondent from Washington, D.C. Colin, I'm just trying to think back to where I last heard these kind of reports. And I know, during the Trump era, that's when it was. And children were separated from their parents and boxed in cages then as well. Nothing's changed, has it?
No, nothing has really changed. I mean, there was a fluctuation where there was a decrease of some of these stories, but that could be because of the limited media access. And now you have a different administration that's Democratic. So now you have Republicans who are quick to point out the inadequacies. And so now you have Congress people and lawmakers who are quick to point out the inadequacies of the current administration. And so you have a Texas congressman who took these pictures, and it makes you wonder the political reasons behind that. But the fact of the matter is, there is an issue happening at the border. Some would characterize it as a crisis. As we're getting more people who are coming to the border, there are less facilities to process these people who want to come in. And of course, this can create crisis-like conditions. And it's up to the Biden administration to really do something about this. This is really bad for the administration, especially since a lot of people voted for the current administration because of the atrocities that happened from the last administration. And some would say were caused by the previous administration before that, the Obama administration, that created some of these detention facilities that some would characterize as less than humane. And so what we have is a situation at the border where you have an influx of people with very few places to go. Sometimes children are just coming across looking for a new opportunity, and they don't have there's no way or proper process to get these children through and get them either asylum or put them through the due process to get them any kind of citizenship. It's just not happening.
And very quickly, Colin, is there an expectation that there will be reforms to the U.S. immigration policy with regards to...
Yeah, there will be, and we're unclear as to what those actually would be at this point, because there are so many policies that have already been put in place, and the fact that the detention facilities have really gone back several years, they would have to do something almost radical to really change the situation there. They've already rejected a wall being built, which really doesn't answer the issue of people coming across the border and how they're being processed and matched with attorneys to seek asylum or whatever. So there's going to have to be a radical change here, which would include lots of money, and that will have to come from Congress. And right now we have a divided Congress, so it's very unclear as to how this situation will be resolved.
Indeed, it's a very disturbing situation. Colin, thank you very much indeed for that. Colin Campbell, the health correspondent, joining us from Washington, D.C. Now, the death toll from Sunday's gun attacks in Niger's Tethwa region has risen to 137. Security officials say the deaths occurred when armed men on motorbikes raided three villages near the border with Mali and Burkina Faso. A government spokesman said armed bandits now systematically target civilians and slam the bloodshed as brutal and horrific. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but officials have blamed the attacks on Daesh terrorists and their affiliates. Violence has surged in the Niger border areas in recent weeks. On March 15th, 66 people were killed in a similar raid in the Tillaberi region. Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip have held a sit-in protest to show solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli prisons. The protest has also called for an end to Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Prisoners' rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, over 4,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in Israeli jails under inhumane conditions. They include some 700 administrative detainees, as well as dozens of women and close to 200 minors under the age of 18, held in harsh conditions.
Protesters stressed the necessity of joining the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement against Israel, BDS, and punish the Israeli regime for its crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
The BDS movement has been working hard to expose Israeli crimes in Israeli jails, and we are lobbying people around the world to help us in defending the rights of the Palestinian people. We must maintain strong boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the Israeli occupation.
Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers under inhumane conditions. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, said that Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, normalizing relations with the Israeli regime, are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
Normalization by some Arab regimes has increased the suffering of Palestinians in Israeli prisons and has encouraged the Zionist regime to increase its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners. Normalization is a crime against all Palestinians, especially those languishing inside Israeli jails.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has imprisoned around 1 million Palestinians, including women and children, since 1967, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A massive fire has swept through a Rohingya refugee camp in the southeastern Bangladeshi coastal town of Cox's Bazar, killing several people. Fire services and rescue teams were dispatched to the scene to deal with the crisis. However, hundreds of tents and a number of health and other facilities are said to have been destroyed. According to local officials, five people are feared to have died and some 20,000 camp dwellers were forced to flee. This was the third fire to hit the settlement in 4 days, but the cause of the incident is still unknown. The Cox's Bazar refugee camp is home to about 100,000 refugees who had fled a state-sponsored crackdown in Myanmar's Rakhine State. About 1 million Rohingya Muslims have crossed into Bangladesh since 2017. India is the world's second most populous nation and has seen tremendous growth in the past 2 decades, but the country is still struggling to feed a large chunk of its population. As Munawar Zaman reports, the country produces sufficient food to feed its population, but is unable to provide its access amid a pandemic. Here is more from New Delhi.
This part of the world has been on the limelight since the last few decades for its impressive growth and development. But the benefits of development are not reaching to its impoverished section. India, the world's second most populous nation and a diverse country, is still struggling to feed millions as hunger continues to be a challenging task for successive governments. For those having tough times to feed themselves, growth and development is just for a TV and a newspaper, since their lives have not changed.
This pandemic has created a humanitarian crisis in India. We saw that with the lockdown, millions of people started walking. Now, all of those people, they suddenly went from earning, 10,000, 15,000 to earning zero and having no savings to fall back on.
Based on the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World 2020 report, there are some 189 million undernourished people in India, which accounts to about 14% of country's overall population, which includes women and children, putting the future generation of the country at huge stake. Experts say government programs and schemes need a vigorous implementation.
It's also a challenge of not having enough coverage within the food security law. So like in a place like Delhi, only 37% of the population has access to rations under that food security law, whereas more than 50% of Delhi lives in slum or slum-like conditions.
India's aim to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals by 2030 includes providing nutrition to all, and ending hunger looks like a challenging task for the country, keeping in view the geography and the population. On the other hand, experts say addressing the stark food inequality and robust distribution system is the most vital way forward.
Many reports, surveys, and studies suggest that India has the largest number of undernourished people in the world. However, the government has time and again junked these reports, questioning the methodology of their calculating the hunger index, saying India has made progress in feeding the most deprived over the last decade. Experts, however, say the country needs to strengthen its delivery system and programs to achieve a lasting solution. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Elsewhere, the United States, Canada, and Britain have denounced China for alleged human rights violations of the country's ethnic Uyghur Muslim community in the Xinjiang region. In a joint statement, the foreign ministers of the three countries called for justice for the people being suffered in the Chinese autonomous region. They, along with the European Union, also imposed sanctions on several Chinese officials over alleged abuse of the Uyghurs. China has expressed disappointment over the move, describing it as a wrong decision. Beijing also hits back by slapping sanctions on 10 European individuals and 4 entities. China said the EU's action is based on lies and disinformation and amounts to gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Meanwhile, the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, slammed China's retaliatory sanctions as unacceptable. Political commentator Wilmer Leon says the sanctions imposed on Beijing are the result of a failed meeting between the US and China in Alaska.
I think that's a very good and accurate assessment, particularly coming out of what I would call the failed meetings in Alaska on Friday, as the United States came into the meeting trying to lecture China as though China were some type of a subordinate country. So now you have the EU issuing sanctions, and the way that the BBC reports it is that this was a coordinated effort between the United States, the UK, Canada, and the EU. So in response to that, China is taking matters into its own hands and letting the world know that it is a sovereign nation, that it is a power a nation that needs to be respected and will not be taken advantage of.
Jordan has registered more than 100 new coronavirus deaths, the record single-day fatality since the disease first appeared in the kingdom. The Jordanian Health Ministry also reported over 9,200 new cases in 24 hours. The latest figures have pushed the country's overall death toll to nearly 6,000 out of over 500,000 cases so far. Meanwhile, Turkey logged over 22,000 new daily cases, the highest since mid-December. Turkish officials have so far recorded more than 30,000 deaths and some 3 million confirmed cases. Officials in several countries, including Jordan, have blamed new variants for the recent surge in cases. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has warned of shortcomings in vaccine distributions, especially to poorer countries. The body said that an unequal allocation would lead to the emergence of more variants.
The gap between the number of vaccines administered in rich countries and the number of vaccines administered through COVAX is growing every single day and becoming more grotesque every day.
Gabriel Jesus said it was shocking to see how little had been done to avert an entirely, quote, predictable, catastrophic moral failure to ensure the equitable distribution of vaccines. The WHO chief noted that the inequitable distribution is not just a moral outrage, but also self-defeating economically and epidemiologically. So far, over 123 million coronavirus cases have been reported globally. The virus has also claimed more than 2.7 million lives so far. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
In like steps with the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
in the limelight.
The COVID-19 pandemic and Texas energy crisis have both highlighted a crucial fact. Losing power can be lethal. This makes every energy access a critical human right. Yet families continue to lose power not only because of extreme weather and other climate fuel disasters, but also because of utility greed and government failures to regulate. When Americans cannot pay their essential utility bills, they risk being disconnected from life-sustaining services. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. Life and Death Crisis as Utilities Cut Power to over 765,000 across 10 states during pandemic. Here's more. The American problem of utility shutoffs for non-payment is a long-standing crisis. Utilities have been disproportionately burdening low-wealth communities and those of color with high energy costs and shutoffs for years. But during a public health emergency, when Americans have been asked to stay home to protect their own health and that of others, losing power and other essential utility services is particularly dangerous. Recent research has shown that if there had been a nationwide utility shutoff moratorium in place since March 2020, as many as 77,000 lives lost to COVID might have been saved. American utility companies in just 10 states have reported more than 750,000 residential electricity shutoffs since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, with one Florida firm accounting for a third of the power cuts, according to a report published recently by the Center for Biological Diversity. The report entitled Power Crisis found that electric companies have performed at least 765,262 household disconnects in 10 states, with the overwhelming majority of the shutoffs occurring due to the customer non-payment. To prepare the report, the CBD surveyed utility commissions in all 50 states to determine whether they collect data on consumer disconnections due to non-payment. The vast majority of states do not require power companies to disclose their household shutoff data. Only 20 state utility commissions offer concise disconnection data. 10 of these have enacted shutoff moratoria and therefore reported zero disconnections. The report focuses on 10 states without moratoria that disclose their disconnection data: Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, North Carolina, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and West Virginia. According to the recent report, major private utilities that disproportionately disconnect service include Duke Energy, which reported nearly 98,000 disconnects across three states, including Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina, equivalent to 2% of the company's customers in those states. Georgia Power, which reported more than 131,000 disconnects since July, equivalent to 6% of the company's customers, and Florida Power and Light, which reported more than 255,000 disconnects since October, equivalent to 3% of the company's customers. The COVID-19 pandemic and Texas energy crisis have both highlighted a crucial fact. Losing power can be lethal, the report states. This makes energy access a critical human right. Yet, American families continue to lose power not only because of extreme weather and other climate-fueled disasters, but also because of utility greed and government failures to regulate. When Americans cannot pay their essential utility bills, they risk being disconnected from life-sustaining services. Gary Ryan, an energy policy analyst at the CBD and the author of the report, said in a statement recently that these alarming shutoff numbers from just 10 states suggest a much broader problem for families across the United States. Being cut off from electricity is devastating under any circumstance, but it's a matter of life and death during a pandemic when the best defense against disease is to stay home, she added. The Biden administration needs to impose a nationwide shutoffs moratorium immediately. The new report comes just 3 days after activists rallied outside the Department of Health and Human Services building in Washington, D.C., urging Biden to issue a nationwide moratorium on utility shutoffs. It's been 1 year since COVID-19 started ravaging the country, but Congress, the president, and local officials are still not protecting access to life-saving utility services, CBD energy justice campaigner Gabby Sari-Tobar said at the demonstration.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salamun alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
So, dear audience, in the previous program, we were discussing about a question that where mother is asking, I enrolled my two boys to gymnastics a few months ago, and they were doing really well. But all of a sudden, they lost all motivation for it. I don't think anything specific happened, but they just don't want to go anymore. My children are 7 and 5. What do you advise me to do? So we're talking with Brother Miqdad, and he has given us some good points. Brother Miqdad, if you don't mind, I'll quickly ask a question. Do you think that is there any role of the gymnastics center they go to? Like, they can do something so that the children stay motivated?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, so we will talk about the events that could have happened that the child lost motivation. One of them, as you mentioned, could be the center itself, could be the teacher itself, could be the peers that are there that the child is doing gymnastics with.
Yeah.
So all these different factors could have an impact on the child's motivation. Inshallah, we'll tackle each one of them slowly. Before I go on to that, I'd like to come back to something I said on the previous show, which is that when a child loses motivation, comes home, says, I don't want to do this ever again. I'm not happy. It's not fun anymore. A lot of parents might think that, you know what, my child's happiness is very important. My child should listen to whatever my child says. And therefore, that's it. Okay, you don't have to go about it anymore. Don't worry, I'll call the center tomorrow and we'll cancel our subscription. I don't think this is the way forward for many reasons. A couple of them is that, first and foremost, you have to realize that children make decisions very, very quickly. It's possible
that they don't think about it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's
the
possible
consequences,
that
yeah.
It's very possible that the same child, you're going to call the center, cancel the subscription, the next day he's going to wake up and be like, I want to go gymnastics,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
So don't quickly jump to conclusions. And secondly is that we need to teach children about perseverance, which I talked about in the previous show as well. And you realize that if we were to cancel and just do what children say so quickly, then children don't learn any sort of patience or appreciation.
Yeah.
And what will happen is that slowly they'll just never be content with anything, because everything will be just as a matter of a trial thing. You know, when you go to a buffet, for example, a big restaurant, you've got 25 different plates out there of different types of food to eat. You can pick and choose from all of them, basically, right? And you go to the first plate, there's some nice chicken, I don't know, nice chicken curry, you take some of that, okay? But you just take a little bit to taste it, because you know that the next one might be a bit better.
Yeah.
So let me try that one then. And you try that one, then you try every single bit of them.
Yeah.
You're never going to be full. Mm-hmm. You're never going to enjoy a proper meal.
Yeah.
Okay. Always hoping that there will be something else that will actually make you taste, that will actually taste better or make you more, you'll enjoy it a bit more.
Yeah.
Those kind of people, they're never stable in their life. They're not content. They're not ready to bear the difficulties to appreciate what they have. Always looking for the
so
grass
they're
that
always
might be
in search of a thing that can give more joy to them.
Exactly. The grass might be always be greener on the other side.
Yeah, it's true.
One thing you want to teach the children, right now we've subscribed to gymnastics. We made a decision that it was a good thing. We made the decision together. It's very important when you make a decision with a child. Make sure the child is involved as well. Even if it's a five-year-old, tell the five-year-old, we think gymnastics is nice. Would you think, let's just try it. Let's go together, try it. And then before you sign it, decide together. Are you ready to do it? This is what the consequence of this is. And we have to stick to it. And when you've decided that, then you teach a child that now that we've decided, we'll have to bear with it, even though it's difficult. This somehow teaches the child to be content, to appreciate what they have, right? Even though at time we have ups and downs in how much we're enjoying it or in our motivation, right? This is fundamental. Unfortunately, you see this in adults as well. In their spirituality, for example, they listen to a lecture or a motivational speaker and suddenly they want to try reciting a particular Quran verse, for example, or recite Salatul Layl, for example. Right? Then they do this for a few days or a few weeks, and then as soon as the motivation goes away, they just abandon the act altogether.
It's just a spark at the moment which doesn't last long.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is an instability that will never lead someone anywhere, right? You want to carry on what you're doing till the end, even though at times the motivation level might be low.
Thank you so much, Brother Mikhdad. So dear audience, please stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Wait, stop! I got Mary Jane!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And Brother McDowell mentioned the importance of contentment and perseverance. So, Brother McDowell, please continue.
Now, having said all of that, obviously, definitely, if something has happened that is worth looking into, then definitely don't force a child to go. Mm-hmm. We need to look at it from a more holistic picture as well. Yeah. If there is a particular incident that has happened that has led a child to, for example, feel really down or affecting his self-confidence or self-respect, basically finding out the real cause of what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's simply, as was mentioned in the question, if it's simply a lack of motivation that is just a normal part of the human behavior, that ups and downs, basically, then this is where we were talking about.
So, Brother Madal, let me ask you a question. That can the children take a day off, like, you know, not going to gymnastics and see, like, what it might lead to?
It's advisable not to, because it's the easier way out to actually drop it completely then, right? So you have a day off once and then twice, and then it's much easier to quit at that point. So no, if there is no obstacles or no concerns, then don't even take a day off.
Mm-hmm.
Just let's go with it, basically. Give as much support as you can. Pack more chocolates in the snack in for the breaks, for example. Drop them yourself. Give them as much boost and energy as we can, but keep at it, even in low motivation period. The moment you take a break one day, it's like, okay, fine, today you don't have to go, and then tomorrow you have to go, and then it's a downhill slope, and then it's just going to go towards canceling again. So don't allow that giving up feeling to come. No, we're at it, we're going towards all the way to it, even if we don't enjoy it so much for now. It's still just 1 hour a session. Let's just bear it. Inshallah, it will give us reward.
Yeah, that's right.
Carry on. Focus on this, what we talked about in the previous show as well. The sense of achievement is very important. One of the motivation that we want to focus on, even more than fun, is the sense of achievement. So if you are going to, for example, encourage your children, then focus on fun, for sure, on being with friends, on the benefits, etc. But also work on this attention towards the sense of achievement that child has. So ask them to, for example, show you the move that they learned. Ask them how they were before they went to gymnastics, or the first few weeks of gymnastics, and now, and realize how much they've progressed and how they've achieved quite a lot. On that note, don't create expectations that are more than they can actually bear. Sometimes, you know, perhaps not in gymnastics, because I don't know the people that are in gymnastics, but in football, we do that sometimes. You send a child to a football class, and you probably have the impression that you're going to be the next Messi or the next Ronaldo, basically, right? Creating expectations that are greater than the child can bear. And this actually leads to a negative impact on the child, affects self-confidence as well. That obviously, I can't achieve that much, and my parents want me to be that at that level.
So like this type of extreme motivation.
Exactly, yeah. So we keep that expectation, even in gymnastics, so you keep that expectation to that which they can. Right? So the achievement, the sense of achievement is really felt. I expected this from you, and you managed to do it, or if not, you've managed even greater than what I expected.
Thanks so much, Brother Maghdad, and your audience will be right back after a short break. Do not go anywhere.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood, so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we're discussing how to keep our children motivated and how we shouldn't have higher expectations from our children, which can lead to their demotivation. So, Brother Maghdad, if you don't mind, I want to ask a question. Like, so in all this situation, what's the role of the gymnastics center itself? Like, what can they do to keep the children motivated?
So, the gymnastics centers, there's a lot of things that they can do, obviously. So, one of them is, depending on the age of the child, we're talking about 7 to 5-year-olds over here, right? So, one of them is fun. As we said, fun is one of the motivations. So, keep the fun going. When you do gymnastics, there's different ways to do gymnastics. I mean, I'm sure that the coaches and the trainers know better than I do. You come up with activities, you come up with games, that are gymnastics-related games, obviously, but that involve fun. Mm-hmm. Gentle competitions involve laughter sometimes as well. The more fun there is, the more the motivation always remains. If it's a matter, and you learn this in coaching, any sports coaching basically, that you always have games that are alternating basically. Mm-hmm. You'd always change what you do.
Yeah.
If you keep it monotonous, that you have to do the same warm-up all over again, you have to do the same stretch-up all over again, you have to do the same moves all over again, it becomes quite boring. And especially for five-year-olds, that they keep doing the same thing, repetitive movement is actually quite boring, right? You want to create different activities, be inventive in how we do things, even in sports. And this actually keeps up the motivation level.
They just have the feeling that they're learning something new.
So the second one is that they should be a sense of success, a sense of winning, a sense of growth, and as you mentioned, a sense of I'm learning something new. And this is where the teacher and the coach, the trainer needs to actually highlight this, that today we're going to be learning something new. Yeah. And at the end of the session, today we learned something new. This was very good. Yeah. And when you approach individual children, you show them and appreciate that they've actually gained quite a lot since the last session. Last session you couldn't do this, now you can do this. Last session you could only do 10 of these, now you're able to do 15 of this. There's actually a growth. The child feels a sense of growth, a sense of achievement. And this is a very good motivation. He goes home and that's the first thing he tells his parents, right? That last week I couldn't do this, this week I managed to do this. Another thing that gymnastics can do is to create a lot of team building, right? Children, one of the things that they really enjoy is working together with friends. Now, on the side of the parents, it's good if you manage to send your children with their own friends. But most times, if that's not possible, then it's for the children to find friends in the gymnastics. If they feel very lonely, if they feel that they haven't built any connection, any relationship with any peers out there, then they'll feel demotivated. So one of the ways to keep motivation between for children is to create a bond between them, friendship. And this happens through working teams, working together, activities that involve teamwork. Now, I know in gymnastics, it's not always the case because gymnastics is not kind of a team sport, obviously. But you can still do, in order to practice the different moves that are out there, you can still do a lot of team activities.
But you should still have a good company at these.
Exactly. If you have good company, then the motivation remains, basically. Being lonely or feeling isolated is things that actually demotivates a child from attending to these sessions. Lastly, and we'll talk about this possibly in the next show as well, is ensure that those negative factors are not involved and not play a role in gymnastics. Things like too much criticism, things that affect the child's confidence, these things obviously will then lead to a lack of motivation, which inshallah we can talk about in the next session.
Okay, so thank you so much, Brother Meghdad, and dear audience, we'll see you in the next show. And thank you so much for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to a United Nations World Food Programme WF report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. We have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Robin Scher, writer. This article is published under the heading, Pandemic may have left 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. Here's more. According to a United Nations World Food Programme report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic as well as the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children due to the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Latino families. Indeed, families of color are being disproportionately impacted. According to an analysis of new census data by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, 22% of Black and 21% of Latino respondents reported not having enough to eat, compared to just 9% with white people. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. He added, "In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries. And in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation." The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about 8 times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date, wrote Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children. For so many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, UNICEF and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies was a common sight. As CNN reported in March 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. In Vermont, for instance, a steady increase in food insecurity since the start of the pandemic has correlated to employment levels, according to a survey conducted by the University of Vermont between March and April 2020. Approximately 45% of respondents had either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or had their hours reduced during the pandemic. And a further two-thirds of survey participants who recorded scarcity of food in their households had experienced job losses or work disruptions since the outbreak of the pandemic, according to the survey. Vermont is just one example. The impact has been felt across the U.S. during the week before Thanksgiving last year. The Guardian reported that 5.6 million U.S. households struggled to put enough food on the table. While referring to the analysis of the census data by CBPP, as the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain. With factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19, there has been a commitment decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers across the U.S. were already facing labor shortages prior to the pandemic. And with tightened immigration as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors may struggle to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon, "Among the many necessary systematic changes, 2020 has illuminated the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored matter. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared to the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food banks are under tremendous pressure to meet the skyrocketing demand, wrote Claire Bainbow Fonaut, Feeding America CEO, and Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau, to then Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in April of last year. At the same time, however, we are seeing literally tons of agricultural goods being discarded because of the shutdown of so much of the economy. Consumer demand has shifted from eating out at restaurants and food services away from home, and food supply chain operations have had to be retooled. And that impact has been felt within the transportation sector. Forbes reported that Andrew Novowick, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, points to a number of weak spots in the food transportation system that could be aggravated by the increased demand for food. A shortage of truck drivers is one potential weak spot, says Novavik. Although he concedes there is debate on this matter, he maintains that trucking companies are finding it much harder to recruit those long-haul drivers. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As The Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in Zambia.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.